This interview with Professor April DeKoenig of Rice University was recorded in November 2009. It's a pleasure to be here with you, and I thought we might just start by having you tell us what it is that you study. What's your area of expertise and interest right now?
I am a professor of the New Testament and Christian origins, so I work in the biblical materials as well as the extra-biblical materials. The materials that are extra-biblical are works that were written by the early Christians approximately during the same time period that some of the New Testament material was coming together, and then a little later than that into the second century.
There's something called the Nag Hammadi Collection, and I'm wondering if you could tell us basically what it is and why it's significant.
The Nag Hammadi Collection is materials that were found in and around Nag Hammadi, Egypt. They were found in the 1940s, and there's a collection of 13 books. And within them are texts that were written by various types of Christians in the 2nd and 3rd centuries. The manuscripts themselves were copied in the 4th century, and they were translated from Greek into Coptic. Coptic is an Egyptian language that the Christians were using to spread their message in Egypt. The Nag Hammadi materials have, initially when they were being studied, were labeled Gnostic, mainly because I think scholars didn't know what else to do with them. Now, over the last 50 years, we've had a lot of time to look at those texts, and we realize now that although some of the texts we would label Gnostic, some of them are not. And so texts like the Gospel of Thomas, probably the Dialogue of the Savior, the Book of Thomas the Athlete, there's even a fragment of Plato's Republic in the Nag Hammadi Library. These sorts of texts are not Gnostic, they're something else. So we've done a lot of work in figuring out the different types of varieties of Christianity that are being witnessed in this corpus of material. But it's a very significant collection because some of the materials come from the early 2nd century. So we're talking, if we put this in perspective, we're talking about some of these materials coming about being written at the same time the pastoral epistles in the New Testament are being written, which are about 135.
Can you tell us, are there a certain criteria that you're using when you classify a group of texts as Gnostic?
One of the things that I can point to in terms of what makes a text Gnostic, they have a different view of God. Their God, they believe, lives outside this universe. So I call him a transcosmic deity, and he's a supreme deity outside of the material universe. And the universe includes the earth, the sublunar sphere, and then the seven heavens and the zodiac around that. Outside of that is where this God lives. Now, this God is in some sort of oppositional relationship to the biblical God, who's the creator of this world and who's living in either the seventh heaven or the zodiac sphere in our text. So we have mainly the idea here is that the Gnostic understands that at death, when the soul's released from the body, that it needs to journey past this biblical God and get by him, get out of the universe, and get back to this transcendent deity who lives beyond. This is not an unusual position in the ancient world. There are other people talking about this. The Platonic philosophers, for instance, understand that God, the good, lives outside this universe. So this model that they're putting into place, they're doing because they're taking the biblical materials, which are really important to them, and they want the biblical material to remain scripture, but they want it to mesh with their understanding of the cosmos, which is Platonic. So it's almost like the debate today between science and evolution. You know, how do you make the Bible work in a world where your cosmos is not biblical anymore? And this is what these people were trying to do. They were intellectuals. They were trying to make philosophy and religion mesh.
So they didn't have an issue with two gods?
No, there's not an issue with two gods. The ancient world was a world where you have a lot of gods populating the spheres, and so that doesn't seem to play a major role. What the Christians were interested in was worshiping the one supreme God, and the other ones are more like lesser powers. They're like powerful angels. They would call them gods, they call them angels, they call them spirits, they call them rulers. So there's a lot of titles, but they're not the God that you're worshiping. So they can still understand themselves to be monotheistic.
And Jesus fits in how?
And Jesus fits in the Christian Gnostic system because he's the mediator that is sent down from the divine realm into the cosmos. And when he gets here, he's the one that tells everybody, hey, look, you aren't from this universe. You're from the high God who lives beyond. And then he teaches them the proper rituals in order to release their soul and so that they can safely journey out of here. Because the other thing you have to recognize is that the Gnostics, unlike the Platonists, understood the earthly realm and the celestial realm to be filled with demons. So these powers that are living there are not good gods. They're demonic gods. And so they're very scary. And when you die, you encounter them. And so you need some kind of means to appease them and control them in order to get past them. And those are the Gnostic secrets that are being passed on. And each Gnostic group has its own set of secrets, its own passwords, its own ritual procedures, and so forth, in order to get past those demons.
So is Gnosticism present today?
It is present today. There's a group of modern Gnostics. Let me rephrase that. They're actually a group of Gnostics who are still living. Their tradition is very ancient, going back into the antiquity. We don't actually know how far, but I would say that their traditions probably go back to the 2nd century, maybe even the 1st century. They call themselves today Mandeans, which means the knowers, and their homeland is Iran and Iraq. These appear to be a group of ancient people who migrated through Palestine and the Jordan area and then up through Syria and pushed east and settled. And so they have a religion that is a Gnostic religion, and it is a blend of Zoroastrianism, of some Jewish materials, and they connect themselves, although they don't understand John the Baptist to be their founder, they connect themselves with him, and they have a book of liturgies they attribute to him. And these people now are highly persecuted due to the war in Iraq, and they are now experiencing a diaspora. So they're dispersing many of them to the United States, many of them to Australia and other countries. And now they're finding themselves in the midst of a very different world, and I imagine that they are going to begin to accommodate to the bigger society. And so I don't know how long the old traditions will survive.
You recently wrote a book called The 13th Apostle, What the Gospel of Judas Really Says. To what were you reacting when you wrote that book?
Well, the book is about the Gospel of Judas, which came to light initially came to light, we're told, in the 1970s when it was actually found somewhere in Egypt, although we don't really know all the details about who found it or exactly where it was found. But it was not available to anyone until about 2000, and I'm not sure what all of I'm not sure how it came into the hands of National Geographic, but National Geographic put together a team to restore the text and then to transcribe and translate it, And that was released in 2006. So all of us, scholars and public alike, this was a brand new release. None of us knew anything about it because the scholars who were working with National Geographic signed non-disclosure statements, which made it impossible for them to consult with the larger academic community about the find and about the translation and transcription. So when it was released and I began working on the Coptic translation, I began to notice that my own translation of the materials was differing from the one that had been published by National Geographic. And I noticed that it was differing in really peculiar ways, particularly around the figure Judas. He was portrayed as quite a positive figure in the original translation, and I was finding in my own translation and my own interpretation of the text that he actually was still a demon and was still quite an evil character. And so I wrote the book in order to explain that.
On your blog, you recently commented on National Geographic's treatment of the Apocalypse of Gabriel, and you characterized it as a sensationalist treatment of the material. I'm wondering if you'd care to comment more on that.
What I'm seeing with the media in general is when something new is being found and discussed with when the media finds out and begins to discuss it, that they tend to take as sensational a position as they can on whatever the piece is that they're describing. And often they're not waiting until the piece has been discussed by academics and we figure out what it is we have. Because this process can take a while. I mean, it can take years for us to transcribe a text correctly or as accurately as possible and come to a consensus as a community on what it actually says in translation. And that's the best thing to do. But the media is not interested in that process because it's dull. And it's not, and they want news, I suppose, to share with the public, and so they tend to, when they're getting these new pieces, go with an initial interpretation, and then the initial reaction to the interpretation if they've even waited that long, and so it's often the initial interpretation is rarely the one that survives. It's usually worked through by scholars back and forth until some sort of a medial position is arrived at.
You have done a lot of work on the Gospel of Thomas, another text that has received a lot of attention from the media. What is the Gospel of Thomas's relationship to early Christianity?
This, again, is a highly contested text. There are really two opinions on it. There are the folks that say that it's an early text and has a lot to do with Christian origins, and then there are people who say that it's not an early text, that it's late second century and it's dependent on the Synoptic Gospels, and therefore it doesn't have a lot to do with the origins of Christianity. And I kind of find myself in the middle of that, and not in terms of taking a position either or, but my work, I've tried to start a conversation to break down those boundaries. And what my work has shown to me is that there was an early, I call it a kernel of material. It was a smaller gospel of sayings of Jesus that appears to have traveled around. And this particular one ends up in Edessa and is deposited there, perhaps by missionaries who are carrying around these sayings gospels. And as when it's left within this community, and this community uses it in its liturgy and or its teaching, however it's being used, it changes. Because when you move a text into, and here we're in an oral environment, so when you move a written text like this would have been a memory device. It would have been there for the leaders to make reference to, and then they're going to go out to the community and they're going to give their talk. So when it was performed again and again and again, new sayings would have been added to this over time, and the theology would have developed in whatever direction that community was. And that's what we have with the full Gospel of Thomas, is we have that developed text. And it looks like that text, we've got it developing up to probably about 120 to 150. We've got this sort of development in the text. And so what it becomes really difficult to say what is dependent and what is independent material. In other words, what's dependent on the Gospels and what isn't. I mean, here I'm talking the New Testament Gospels. Because certainly over time, as Matthew, Mark, and Luke become distributed and become part of the religious communities and their liturgies, those Gospels, forms of the sayings are going to affect how the Thomas material is re-performed. So it's really complicated, and there may not be an answer. In other words, we might not be able to know. And this is not something that scholars like or the public likes, because we want to have everything, you know, with, you know, our T's crossed and our I's dotted. But when you're dealing in an oral, we call it an oral and rhetorical environment, it's very hard to make these sorts of distinctions.